I have waited a long time for this moment, 10 years to be exact. And now I am so happy to be able to take this wonderful opportunity to tell all of you how deeply sorry I am and how much I regret the carving on the witch's table and the inscription on the tombstone. Not because I didn't mean every line of them, but simply because I'm sick to death of being asked to explain and apologize. Gotcha. It has occurred to me in a few weak moments since January 4th that one of the reasons St. George and the Dragon may have been selected for the Caldecott Medal is that it's the cleanest, most innocent, least likely to offend book I've ever illustrated. And if that's so, well, it wasn't my fault. I just draw what the story tells me to draw. This one happened to be pure in heart, that's all. Although, once you've established a reputation, it seems to follow you around. Shortly after St. George was published, my friend Cindy Zekeris called me up and said, "Oh, Trina, you devil dog, you. How sneaky and clever you were to make that apple tree a sexy naked woman reaching out for George." "What are you talking about, Cindy? What naked woman?" "Come on, Trina, the apple tree. You know, the one George is sleeping under. It's a nude woman, upside down. Terrific." Well, that apple tree on page 22 happens to live in my backyard, and if there's a naked lady in it, I never knew she was there. But when I hung up the phone, I realized that I was already mentally composing a letter of explanation and apology to answer the flood of outrage letters from parents and teachers and the Dallas Public Library. Happily, Cindy is the only one who's ever seen the naked lady, and don't ask me to point it out to you because I still can't see it. I know what she means, though. One of the nicest things about being an artist is the ability to see things a little differently, a little more carefully, perhaps a little more imaginatively than most other people do. To be able to see the possibilities in things, to see the magic in them, to see what it is that makes that thing inherently itself. And then sometimes to go beyond the surface of the thing and see what it is that the thing wishes to become. The cities that live in clouds, the landscapes that become sleeping bodies, the human face that becomes an animal, the tree that becomes a woman. When I was a child, it was easy for me to see these transformations, the hidden souls of everyday things. At any moment, the sky could produce a long-lost fairy tale city. A chair would leer at me with the face of a demon. A leaf turned into an insect and hopped away. My sister turned to look at me with the face of a cat, or an apple tree changed, with the light, into a beautiful woman. It never occurred to me to disbelieve anything that I read in Grimm's fairy tales or in the Greek and Norse myths that I love so much. It was quite clear to me that everything in the world was under a spell of enchantment, and that the most ordinary objects had a secret life of their own. Everything, the wind, the trees, coffee cups, toothbrushes, had a soul. A spirit. It therefore seemed the most natural and believable thing in the world that stones and birds should speak, or that a frog should turn into a prince. My mother and father never discouraged this point of view. As a matter of fact, I think they were rather tickled by what they called my vivid imagination, and they had the good sense to take my fantasies in stride. If I mentioned that there was an angel on the roof, my father would agree that there probably had been. The year I became Little Red Riding Hood, my mother sewed me a very beautiful little red cape with a hood and usually remembered to call me Little Red Riding Hood rather than Trina. When I had to get a vaccination at the doctor's and was about to throw a fit at the sight of the needle, my mother told me not to worry. It was just like Sleeping Beauty being pricked by the spindle. And so I calmly took the shot in the arm and then proceeded to fall into a deep sleep that lasted for 100 years. We believed in fairies in my family. We believed in the power and magic and mystery that exists in nature anyway. After all, if angels are living in the heavens, why shouldn't fairies be hiding in the forest or trolls in the earth? It is easy to see these things once you know they are there. And for me, it has always been easier to draw a picture of what I've seen rather than to try to explain it with words. I draw a lot. I think I was born drawing. I drew because I needed to, as well as for the sheer joy of it. And because I loved to draw, because I was an artist, I learned to look very carefully at things. I learned to watch closely and to remember what I had seen. I learned to look for the things that were hiding or waiting to emerge, as well as the outward appearances of things. Of course, when you go to school, they do their best to knock it all out of you. Most of the grown-up world, it seems, is in a conspiracy to teach us to disbelieve in the magic we see so easily as a child, to deny the existence of those powerful images we see with our hearts rather than with our minds. So school was an unhappy and difficult time for me. A socially backward kid whose only attributes are a vivid imagination and a need to draw pictures all day long was not exactly appreciated in the public school system of Cheltenham Township, Pennsylvania. I was a further pain in the neck because in first grade I preferred reading Edith Hamilton's Greek mythology to following the fascinating saga of Dick and Jane and Spot, line by bumbling line. No one had ever told my parents that it wasn't cool to teach your kid to read books at a decidedly preschool age, and so I was made to suffer in subtle ways for their innocent mistake. However, I was stubborn, and I was tough, with the peculiar kind of toughness that timid children learn to develop. And the Brothers Grimm were strong, stronger than Dick and Jane, and stronger than my grade school teachers. Eventually, I learned to shut up about the angels and to do my real drawings at home, where they wouldn't be subjected to embarrassing questions. I learned to survive, and the fairies and angels survived with me. I have to look a little harder for them now, but I know they are still there, because they have always been there. And one very good thing came out of those school years when I was a stranger in a strange land. It was always very clear to me, and to everyone else, too, exactly what I would do when I grew up. I would be an artist, and I would be the sort of artist who made pictures that told stories. It wasn't until the seventh grade that I learned about the word illustrator, but when I heard it, I knew that that was me. I can't say that I've never wavered from that chosen course. I've always secretly wanted to be a ballet dancer, and once I wanted to be an organist. More realistically, I've always longed to be the sort of artist who simply paints pictures, big, mysterious, grown-up paintings, on canvas, with oil paint. But I can't. I can't because there are too many stories in the world and too many books waiting to be illustrated and not enough time to illustrate them all or to learn how to do it well enough. Besides, I have this consuming, fatal passion for books. The books themselves, the way they look and smell, the feel of them, and of course the stories that they have to tell. When I'm upset or unhappy or depressed, I go to a bookstore for comfort the way other people go to a church or to a therapist. Books and illustrations are a part of me. They're not just what I do, they're what I am. 25 years ago, when I was just starting out as a children's book illustrator, I used to trot across the Boston Common at least once a month with my portfolio to show my latest efforts to Helen Jones, the children's books editor at Little Brown and Company. Helen Jones was a tough, clear-eyed, no-nonsense Yankee lady. She was a feminist before we had even started using the word. She was smart, opinionated, had a wicked sense of humor, and did not suffer fools gladly. She cared deeply about children's books and knew everything there was to know about publishing them. I was terrified of her, and I fell in love with her at first sight. I badgered her with my portfolio until she finally gave me a book to do, a collection of Christmas stories and poems by Ruth Sawyer called Joy to the World. It was the start of a long and, for me, tremendously enriching and happy association. It was Helen who gave me my first book of fairy tales to illustrate and who was brave enough to publish a story I'd written called How Six Found Christmas. She gave me the chance to try my hand at illustrating every sort of children's book, picture books, young adult novels, mystery stories, folk tales. She also initiated me into the terrors of speaking before large groups of people. At Helen's insistence, the first time I agreed to speak and draw was to a group of over 1,000 grade school children in John Hancock Hall in Boston. I guess she figured that if I could survive that, I could speak anywhere. She took me to my first ALA convention and my first Newbery Caldecott Awards dinner in 1964. She taught me almost everything I know about how children's books are made, how they are produced, marketed, and sold. When Helen Jones died in 1973, I had one page left to do on a book I had begun at her suggestion. That book was King Stork by Howard Pyle. I finished the job, and then I fell apart. I honestly did not know how I was going to continue my work without her guidance and support. But I did, of course. I did because I had to, and because she would have been furious with me if I hadn't. The subsequent books that I did for Little Brown under Emily MacLeod and John Keller were Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, the kind of lavish picture book fairy tales that Helen might have trusted me with by then if she had been alive. After that, my association with Little Brown became sporadic. Things there had changed, as they were changing everywhere. I began working with various other publishers, and I was involved with Cricket Magazine, and I was also going through several interesting life crises, both personal and professional. During one of the most severe and frightening of these professional life crises, it was Kate and John Briggs and Holiday House who picked me up, dusted me off, and set me back on my feet again. It was they who helped me renew my faith in myself as an illustrator. It was they who suggested that I take the plunge and do an autobiographical picture book, Little Red Riding Hood. At that point, I was even beginning to notice the fairies again. Then, one day in spring of 1983, I got a call from an assistant editor at Little Brown & Company named Karen Klockner. They had a manuscript by Margaret Hodges, a retelling of St. George and the Dragon. Would I be interested in illustrating it? Well, sure, I would take a look at it. And from that first look, I was hooked. Wow, it was good. It was better than good. It was extraordinary. Okay, Helen, I muttered. I'll do it. Later on that summer, I got another phone call, this time from Margaret Hodges. She and her husband were just off to England for a month. Would it be possible for them to come to Lyme on their way back to meet me and to talk about the book? Now, there is an old, unwritten, but very sensible rule in children's book publishing that says you must never let the author and illustrator meet, at least not until after the book is well on its way to the printer. It's a good rule, because authors and illustrators almost never agree on how a book should be illustrated, and because they usually hate each other on first sight anyway. But I wanted to meet Margaret Hodges. I wanted to meet the woman who had crafted this extraordinary bit of prose, and I knew that I also needed her help. I had lots of questions about St. George and the Dragon, the most important one being, what period of history should I set this story in? As usual, with any book that has even the vaguest historical reference, there are piles of reference work to do, because you've got to be careful about particulars. And in this instance, we had Edmund Spenser, who was an Elizabethan, to consider, as well as George himself, who nobody can pin down to a particular period, never mind agree that he existed at all. So I told Margaret Hodges that I would be delighted to meet her and her husband, and to please look for any kind of visual reference material on George that I could use for the book. A month later, when I saw Margaret and Fletcher Hodges walking up my driveway, something magical happened to the landscape. I swear that the light changed. The trees became enchanted princesses, the clouds became castles, and the fairies came out of the flowers. It was a case of love at first sight all over again. We decided during lunch to put our George in his own vague pre-Arthurian time and not in Mr. Spencer's Elizabethan period. We decided that perhaps I could use Spencer's bits about the little sailors and their voyage to bring in something Elizabethan, or that maybe I should make a parallel to the main story in the borders of the pages, using Elizabethan children doing a George and the Dragon mummers play. I had already decided to make this book my own version of an illuminated manuscript with decorative illustrated page borders. Amazingly, it turned out that we agreed completely on how this book should look. In other words, Margaret said, "You do exactly what you think is best, Trina, and I'll like it." Wonder of wonders, we spent the rest of the afternoon talking about fairies. Margaret believes in them, too. Fletcher and my friend Barbara talked about books. New friends, new beginnings, and an exciting new book to work on. Life can be kind. Later on that summer, there was a conference with Karen Klockner and Bob Lowe. Bob has been the art director for children's books at Little Brown for as long as I have been doing books for them. We are the only two left who remember how it was in the old days with Helen Jones. While Helen was teaching me how to be an illustrator, Bob was teaching me how to talk to the printers. It was good to be working with him again. It was also good to work with Karen, who looks like a fairy tale princess and who instantly displayed the qualities I admire most in an editor, the sensitivity and intelligence to leave me alone with the job, and the confidence to say, "Call me if you need me." To be left alone with the job is very important to me. I came into this world alone, and I'll go out of it alone. And each book I do is the same kind of birth and maybe the same kind of death on a smaller scale. I don't do sketches or preliminaries. I think about it instead. I think about the story and about what it means and about how it can be brought to life in pictures. I think about the characters and what makes them tick and where they're coming from and where they might be going to. Who are these people? What do they like to eat for breakfast? How do they react in a situation that's outside the story? What are they really thinking while the story is happening all around them? I think about the landscape. Where is this taking place? What time of year is it? What was the weather like? Was the sky in the 3rd or 4th century AD the same as the sky we see now? Obviously it wasn't. What was it like then? Were the stars brighter, the light more pure, the colors clearer? What was this dragon like? Were there dragons? Of course there were. They still exist somewhere, I bet. So what did he look like? What did he eat for breakfast? I think about all this a lot. I think about it so much that eventually I start to dream about it. And when my dreams start to become the dreams of the characters in the book, when their reality becomes a part of my subconscious, when I can live in their landscape, when I put on the little red cape with a hood and tie the red ribbons under my chin, then I know what to do with my pictures. When I'm halfway into a book, the people who know and love me best always say things like, "You haven't been listening to me. I told you last week that the oil burner sounded weird." Or, "What do you mean you're not coming to my 50th birthday party? I told you about it months ago." Or, "Hey, Trina, the bugs are only 4 months late. I'm going to shoot myself tomorrow in case you're interested." Or, "Trina, I told you about this person. He's very important to me. Where have you been?" Well, I've been in the book. That's where I live now, and it's hard for me to come out of it. I know that there's another world out there going on about its business, but my world is right here with George and his valiant old horse, and Una, and the dwarf, and the lamb, and the donkey. And wow, the dragon is right there waiting for them. Hey, I know you can't hear it, or see it, or smell it, or feel it the way I can, but wait for it. Wait a few days and I'll show you. I'll help you to see it the way it really happened. Look, there are the fairies. They're listening, waiting. The fairies always know how the story will turn out. They stole George when he was a tiny baby. His mom left him in a field just the way some moms today leave their babies in the car when they're shopping in the supermarket. So the fairies took him, and the fairy queen brought him up to be a warrior, strong and clean-limbed and pure-hearted and totally committed. And then she turned him free and said, "Go for it." At about the same time, here comes Una, looking for a hero to kill the dragon that's been destroying her father's kingdom. She's a very strong, self-confident, independent young woman. My research into 4th century England told me that women were brought up that way. They hadn't invented the word feminist then either, but they didn't have to. Women were expected to be self-sufficient and strong. Who else was going to run the kingdom when Daddy and Big Brother and the rest of the menfolk were off fighting wars? We haven't come such a long way, baby. Una travels with the dwarf. I figured he was probably the household astrologer, a servant and at the same time a wise and learned man. Maybe he is a Jew, or an Armenian, or an Arab, someone who was a cripple, an outsider, an observer, a visionary who was left behind by the Romans because he was too embarrassing or too clever to be taken back to Rome as a slave. I think that Una's mother, the queen, asked him to go along on this journey, to look after Una, and more important, to bring back a true report of what happened. She knows that Una is dedicated and save-the-world idealistic, but she also knows about 16-year-old girls. Una takes her pet lamb along, too, obviously for symbolic reasons. I guess that she started out on her journey as soon as the roads were passable, maybe sometime in March. It took her about 3 months to reach the west coast of England, to meet George just as he is riding out into the world for the first time. He is wearing a suit of chainmail that the fairies fashioned for him, and a breastplate of cast-off Roman armor. He is bearing the sword that men will call Excalibur in some future time. His shield comes from the grave of an ancient hero and bears the symbol that the flag of England is based upon, the Red Cross. The fairies are watching them. They know the beginning and the end of this story, but they're curious anyhow, which is one of the most endearing things about fairies. They also know that at this time they are engaged in their own great and perhaps final battle with the angels of the new religion. The angels of Christianity are taking over in the battle for people's hearts and minds. So the fairies have sent their own changeling, their sweetest, most powerful hero, to do the dragon job, who will succeed in his quest and will be called forever a saint on the Christian calendar. It is one of the fairies' last greatest jokes on the world. But Una and George know nothing about this, and neither does the dragon. What is the dragon thinking through all this? The dragon isn't evil or wicked. He isn't anything but an animal. What he's thinking about most is food, and maybe a little stalking and hunting, and then he just wants to be left alone. Maybe he's irritable because he hasn't found a female dragon to mate with in the past 100 years or so. Who knows? The dragon is a nuisance, and he's terrifying like most of the primal forces in nature, and so he has to die. Every morning, unless the temperature is lower than 10 below zero, I take the same 2-mile walk with my dogs. We go down to the river and then past Bernard Tuller's farm and back up the hill to our own road and then home. The landscape of the upper Connecticut River Valley is very like the west country of England and Wales, all sharp little grassy hills and wooded valleys and rocky fields. One misty morning in March, when I was taking this walk and thinking about what the dragon was thinking, I heard him coming towards me across Bernard's cow pasture. I heard him first, like the sound of distant thunder, and then I saw him. I saw the huge shape of the dragon appear on the crest of the hill. And before I even had the chance to be frightened, he was gone. A few days later, I got to the page where George kills the dragon. As I usually do, I read the text on that page over again for the 37th time, and then I read it 5 more times, just to make sure I'd got it right. And then I realized that I couldn't do it. I often say, I can't do it, when all I really mean is that this is going to be very difficult. But this was different. How on earth was I going to show George, somehow having got between the dragon's huge jaws, my dragon, stabbing his sword up through the roof of the monster's mouth and piercing his brain? Do you know what this would look like, really? Can you imagine the blood, the ghastliness, the violence of that scene? You think the carving on the witch's table was bad? I was horrified at the thought of what I had to do, and worse than that, I was stymied. I paced the floor for an hour, and then I made a desperate, unprecedented decision. I called Margaret Hodges. This was the only time in my entire professional life when I knew I was truly beaten. I had to call the author to ask what I should do. Margaret, I wonder if you can help me. I'm just about to start on the spread where George kills the dragon, and I can't do it. I mean, I can't draw it. The whole thing is physically impossible, and besides that, it's disgusting and gross. Oh dear, said Margaret, I do see what you mean. Well, Trina, why don't you just forget about all that and draw the scene after George has killed the dragon? That will be just as dramatic, and maybe it is the best solution. I love you, Margaret Hodges. You're not just a vivid imagination. You're clever as well. It took me 9 months to complete the illustrations for St. George and the Dragon. I learned a lot during those months. I learned about herbs and ancient roses and wild fruits when I decided to decorate my borders with whatever grew in the fields and hedgerows of 4th-century England. I learned that the Romans named England Alba for the many wild white roses that grew there. I learned that the ancient Celts and Britons were terrific weavers and dyers and metalsmiths. I learned that the richest and most valued color in those days was red, so I gave my angels red wings. I learned a lot about lizards and dinosaurs and other strange and wonderful reptiles. I learned about pre-Norman conquest sailing craft and pre-Arthurian armor and weapons. I learned that Winston Churchill wrote the best stuff about prehistoric England and that Arthur Rackham drew the best dragons in the world. I learned that I could give everything I have, all of whatever talent and skill and craft and thought and love and guts and vision I possess, to yet another picture book. And that when it was all finished and done with, it still wasn't good enough. I wish I could have done it better. I wish I could have made you see the dragon the way I saw him that morning on the hillside. I can see the fairies, but I still haven't learned how to draw them the way they really are. Not yet. Maybe next time. And now it's time to stop and time to say thank you. Thank you, Mimi, for giving me my first fairy tales and for allowing me to believe in them. Thank you, Helen Jones. I wish you were here. Thank you, dear Barbara, for putting up with me through St. George and all the other books, too, and for taking all those beautiful slides of my pictures. Thank you, Patricia McMahon, for keeping the dragons at bay. Thank you, Karen Klockner, for being wise and understanding and sensible and courageous. Thank you, Bob Lowe, for being there when I needed you during the work on this book and the 17 others that came before it. It's been a long time, and it seems that we're both good survivors. Thank you, Margaret Hodges, for giving me a story so good that even after I'd read the same paragraph 400 times in a row, the words shone just as pure and clean as if they'd been written with air and fire and stone. And thank you, librarians and members of the American Library Association, for awarding the Caldecott Medal to St. George and the Dragon. You couldn't have given me a nicer surprise.